Poverty and crime are constant companions in our country. Just think about how often we discuss tougher parts of our towns, you know, the poverty and crime-ridden areas. And it's true that some crime is born of desperation and destitution, but we get a more comprehensive look at the connections and disconnections as we get familiar with a new book by Peter Edelman called Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. It focuses on how hard the weight of the criminal justice system often falls upon people who have little or no capacity to support that weight, certainly the financial weight. Peter Edelman worked for Robert Kennedy years ago and went on to work in the Clinton administration, where he resigned over the president's signing of the welfare reform bill. Peter is now a professor of law and public policy at Georgetown University, where he's the faculty director of the Center on Poverty and Inequality. The current book is his second on poverty in America. Peter Edelman, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Is there a view that people are poor because they deserve it? It sounds rather Dickensian, but we sort of seem to go that way, don't we?
Well, unfortunately, that's certainly the view of some people, and the results are that in addition to whatever issues they have, not having a job or having a job that doesn't pay enough to get them out of poverty, what I find with this doing this book is that the hand of criminal so-called justice is making it worse. For people in poverty all over the country.
And you start with a story from Georgia about what appears to be a modern-day debtor's prison. We're not supposed to have debtor's prisons in America, are we?
We are not. For the federal government, actually, they were banned in 1833. And, of course, we have various things over the years. Think about the sharecropper economy, which goes almost up until the present time, maybe some places does, where people are stuck because they never get out of their debt to the plantation owner. And what happens here, where people are arrested on often something very, very small, a misdemeanor or less, and they can't pay the fine, and they get thrown in jail for that, or they're given a so-called payment plan, and these are very, very high fines in many places, fines and fees, and so they get stuck not paying the one payment they're supposed to meet, and that gets them into jail. So for too many people in our country, they just really are stuck and owe more and more money as time passes, and so it really amounts to a 21st century debtor's prison.
Now, there is case law on this. I mean, you bring up a number of cases that bear on situations like these, including Bearden versus Georgia. So why, despite those rulings, do these things keep happening?
Well, because the bottom line on this, we can talk about the details of Bearden and when it applies and when it doesn't, but the bigger point is going back now really into the 80s, As we all know, we've had an anti-tax rebellion that's been going on from then, and of course we see it right now. What's going on in Congress in order to make the rich richer? So it's kind of related to this conversation. But what happened then, and it got worse in the Great Recession of more recent years, is that particularly the courts. Didn't have enough revenue from the state or the county, whatever the appropriating organization was, and so they turned to quote unquote the customers and they started jacking up the fines and jacking up the fees and getting the money to run the courts and other parts of government by taking it out of the hide of the people who were brought into the courts. You and I can pay and be quite angry about it, but at least I find there are many of us on one part of the society who can pay those things. But when it comes down on somebody who has a very low income and they just can't pay, people owe thousands and thousands of dollars in places around the country, and that's really because of the anti-tax rebellion.
Now, I noticed, too, that you mentioned cases where the judge or whoever is hearing cases in court will look at something on the person as evidence that they've got the ability to pay, like they've got expensive tattoos or expensive boots or something.
Yes, that's right. And so that going back to Bearden, there are some judges just don't even. And again, this is you've got some counties in Oregon that are like this, and across the country where they don't even ask whether there's an ability to pay, which Bearden requires. But others, there are judges, including some in the Pacific Northwest, where just what you said, the judge says, well, you've got quite a nice pair of shoes on there, or you've got a really nice tattoo, so you must be able to pay. And so I've asked whether you can pay. I mean, I've answered the question whether you can pay, and that's it. You can pay, and the end of story. So they claim that they are doing it under Bearden, but they're really not.
You mentioned Oregon counties that do some of this. In fact, while we're on case law, there's a case called Fuller versus Oregon. What does that allow?
So that's about, and of course it is about Oregon, that's about the question of having to pay for a public defender. And of course, by definition, you don't get a public defender unless you have very low income. And yet it turns out, which I was just stunned about when writing this book, 43 states in the country do require fees to have a public defender. Essentially, they get around Fuller v. Moore, Oregon. Well, sometimes they just they don't act in compliance with that. And this is something I want to know more about, because I really haven't dug down to why 43 states do this and somebody hasn't sued them, because I think they really are not complying with Fuller.
All right. The book is called Not a Crime to Be Poor. Peter Edelman, the guest. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to The Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about poverty in America and how often it cross sections with crime and doesn't really need to, as Peter Edelman points out just in the title of his book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, subtitled The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Two sections to the book, The Criminalization of Poverty, followed by Ending Poverty. So we have a lot to talk about here on The Exchange, and you can be part of the conversation. Your thoughts, comments, questions on the issues of crime and poverty together. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. See, we're talking about places where because the taxes got lowered, that the fines and fees got raised. I mean, were they directed purposely at the poor or just sort of a byproduct of what had happened?
It's both. These are things, these fines and fees apply to anybody who gets arrested for something, you know, some kind of moving thing or something about the car. And most of these around the country are driver's license suspensions is what they do, and that's where the fines came from. But you know, it might be a bit broken tail light, something like that, and then that gets the process going where people are stuck and can't pay the payments. There is you can see this around the country in particular areas where they're African American, Latino, so on, get the brunt of it. It's kind of a meanness, I think, that goes after people who really can't pay. Now, their point is somebody who's low income can't himself or herself also pay bail is a question. And then the family squeezes their own house budget. Maybe they even sell their plasma in order to get the money to get the loved one out of jail. So there is some logic, if you call it that, for going after lower income, because there is money to be squeezed there, and of course it's terribly destructive. If they're going to get money out of people this way instead of by taxes, which are fairer, it really should only be for people who are able to pay, basically. Now, I'm not talking about more serious things where clearly you have to have, just for civic order, We have to have certain kinds of things. You know, if somebody drives under the influence, we don't have any sympathy for that. Shouldn't. But I'm talking about things that are basically made up. So can I tell you one small story?
Sure.
Well, there's a guy named Adel Edwards who's in my book, and this is down in Georgia, and he's a man who has intellectual disabilities. He can't read and write, and he gets arrested for burning the leaves outside of his house without a permit, $500.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, they say, you're on probation, $528. And it's not probation, it's just money. And in fact, in Georgia and 12 other states, these are for-profit probation companies, although plenty of public probation agencies do this as well. So that's an indication. I mean, that's just a terrible story. He's stuck. In fact, right at the beginning, they tell him he's got to come up with $250, and he can't do that, and so they throw him in jail. And that's Bearden, as we were talking about a minute ago. There are thousands of stories like this around the country, and we really only know the ones when the person happens to find a lawyer. If a lawyer is introduced into things, then he or she can make the argument that it's unconstitutional, and indeed in those cases very often they're able to get the whole city or the whole county there's a finding that it's unconstitutional, and they have to get rid of that policy. But there has to be a lawyer.
There has to be a lawyer, indeed. And that, so this is where things get complicated. We're talking to Peter Edelman about his book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. You just mentioned the man in Georgia who ended up quickly owing $1,000 because he burned leaves without a permit. You mentioned Rosalind Hill in Tulsa, who owed more than $11,000 in fees and fines, starting from what?
That's a person who had some issues in terms of mental illness, and I think there was some alcohol or something like that. But she kept being arrested over and over again for things that should have not even been in the criminal side of things, and she needed help in terms of mental illness. And then it just gets worse and worse because what she owes each time she gets hauled in, the combination of not being able to pay the payments that she already owned, and in her case she had a couple more very minor things. And so it just piles up. And again, that's not unusual. They're just tremendous number of examples like that.
Well, and you point out, too, that if people are going to start getting angry about this being a conservative or a Republican thing, you do bring up the example of Boulder, Colorado, which is a very progressive and democratic town. And you were told there that the juries are terrible.
Well, so, yes, this was a public defender out in Boulder who happened to be a student of mine and at Georgetown Law. And then she was out in Boulder. She told me about this, and of course this is where the question of discrimination, we're talking in Boulder largely about Latino people, and they get nabbed for doing things that the other rest of the population in Boulder has never even questioned about it, you know, riding a bicycle the wrong way, something like that. But again, this is something that you see over and over again where there's this, what should we say, a pairing in the sense that there is this so-called system, except that it gets applied in this discriminatory way. It's not just the money. It's the money and also the racism.
So I've been circling around your central example, Ferguson, Missouri, and I think you might have touched on it briefly already, but a fee system in place there that apparently was a large chunk of the city budget. One of your sources describes Missouri as the land that time forgot. I mean,
yes.
So it's not just Ferguson. I mean, how is it sort of backwards?
Well, so St. Louis County, for reasons that one can't completely understand, except that, as my friend Jonathan Smith is the one who says that in the book, who's a wonderful civil rights lawyer, and it's not, of course, the only place in the United States that was never touched by the civil rights movement and other things that have moved along. So what we found out, and this is true, this is important in terms of my writing this book, because I didn't really understand that we had really coast to coast and north to south, these kinds of things going on, let alone Ferguson. But we had the terrible tragedy of the killing of Michael Brown, and, you know, unfortunately, we know that there are too many instances where unarmed men, African-American men, this kind of shooting. But we found out in Ferguson, as a consequence of the focus on Ferguson, that they're running this system where they apparently can't get the taxes that they need to run the town, so they just arrest people, the same people, over and over and over again, and to the extent that people can't pay, they throw them in jail. Of course, one of the things is it costs money to put somebody in jail, so it isn't even a very smart strategy. And then one starts looking at it, as I did, and found out that the story of Ferguson and the way in which they're abusing their own citizens is happening, and maybe one thought, okay, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, those people. And then we find out that these kinds of things, the driver's license suspensions, which have nothing to do with safety, they just have to do with collecting money. And that's true in parts of Oregon, and California was the big one on it, and they're kind of gradually getting away from it. But what the Ferguson shock did was, for many of us, was to open our eyes and see that kind of thing is actually a national problem.
National problem listed by Peter Edelman and described in great detail in his book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. You're more than welcome to join this discussion with us on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe you have some questions, some comments, even some stories to share about getting a fix-it ticket or something that turned into much more than that. We'd like to hear from you at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you did mention that this happens in a lot of parts of the country, and in fact, a lot of examples do come from the South, but then you do talk about California, where as of 6 years ago, a $500 ticket actually cost you nearly $2,000.
That's right, and at the top of it, just a few years ago, people woke up to how bad it was, and there was some terrific work done by the Western Center for Law and Poverty in California and some other organizations, and we found out that the cumulative number of license had been taken away in California is 4 million people over that period of time, and they were owing, at the tip of it, the top of it, owing $10 billion. And they realized, finally, that sort of came, they woke up, and gradually, in the last few years, they have changing the law so that it really only hits, or it's coming close anyway, to only hitting people who are dangerous and ought to lose their license. So that's ultimately a good story in California.
But yeah, and in fact, the license suspensions for unpaid tickets was halted by the legislature just this year, actually after the rating of your book was completed. And then just last week, I noticed that Alameda County en masse reinstated all of the all of the suspended licenses.
Right, and also the other thing that Alameda did, there's two big pieces of legislation in California this year. One is to ban taking away driver's licenses if people haven't paid a fine of some kind, which, of course, otherwise mounts the piles up the debt. So that was a big thing this year, AB 103. And then the other one, you're reminding me with Alameda County, the state legislation, this is about kids now, because one of the terrible things that's a sort of an outshoot of this, what we're talking about, is all over the country, we now know that the families have to pay in order for the child, the youth, to get services, whether they're going to be locked up or whether there's some kind of diversion and other kinds of services. And if they can't pay for it, they don't get it. And then if they are put into some residential thing, they're just stuck with debts that go up. Well, in California, they've at least this year knocked out the fees on the juvenile justice side, on the children and youth. They still have the fines.
This is what you call pay to
stay. That's a big step.
This is what you call pay to stay in the book, where essentially
that
you
is pay to stay. Yeah. That is right. And there's pay or stay. In other words, you're brought into the court and you can't pay, and they put you into jail. That's like Adel Edwards. And the other is pay to stay. It's all these different things. And you have to pay to be on probation. You think, oh, that's some terrible state that's got awful politics and mean people or whatever it is. And in fact, having to pay to be on probation, which isn't real probation at all, that's all over the country. And it's public, not for-profit agencies.
As long as you mention for-profit, let's delve in here a little bit, because there are companies that are part of the process, as you indicate here, that in some places are making money where poor people are ending up being their funding source, and they're making a profit.
Yes, that's exactly right, and you have some counties in Oregon that do that.
In what capacity? What do these for-profit companies do?
They collect money.
For what service?
Well, I mean, they do some things, there might be some kind of a test that there has to be, except in a lot of times they will require, and this is both on the adult side and the juvenile side, you have to take a drug abuse test, even though it's somebody who never used drugs. I mean, that's an example. You're on bail, you do get out. And they put, an ankle thing, electronic thing, on you, except you have to pay for that. And it just goes on and on. You go through a long, long list of fees. And again, it's in various parts of Oregon. The problems about the license suspensions and that's so, it's just an awful thing. But people lose their license for something that's not has nothing to do with safety. And then they use their car. They have to. They have to get to work. You know, they have to take their children to school, whatever it is. Then they get arrested again, and they owe more money. It just works, unfortunately, really well. And again, you have counties in Oregon that operate this way.
Peter Edelman, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Not a Crime to Be Poor. Let's get into the area of mentally ill people going to jail. That is getting lots of coverage now, and there's some really gripping examples in the book, including Darren Rainey, and you say if this had happened several times over, he might still be alive.
Well, that's a terrible story. It was in Miami, and Darren Rainey was in the mental section of the Miami, the Dade Center, Dade County. And this man who was mentally ill defecated in his cell, and the correctional officers did something it's just unspeakable. They had rigged up a thing with a shower with boiling water, and they threw him in there and left him there until he died. So that's that. And the only reason we know about it, and this is very, very important, there was a reporter for the Miami Herald who did terrific investigative work and brought that to light. We never would have found out about it. And so that the answers on these things, and the book, as you know, goes into what people are doing, whether it's lawyers or public officials, but also journalists, to bring these things to our attention. And of course, nationally, we're talking about our jails and our prisons are the places where we put people instead of in a place that's for mental health, and instead they're the 21st century place is the jail or the prison. One out of four people who are in a jail or prison have issues of mental illness. 40% of Rikers in New York City, 40% issues of mental illness. And so it's absolutely terrible. And we do see places around the country where people are working on this for change, and I do talk about that. Cook County in Chicago, which is a terrible place, but leadership now that's kind of doing better, and you have a professional PhD psychologist running the jail and now having mental health services that are really making a difference. Same thing happening in Los Angeles. So we see glimmers here and there.
All right, I want to pivot more to solutions and get more into what we can do to get to the place where it doesn't feel so much like it is a crime to be poor. The book is called Not a Crime to be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Peter Edelman, our guest on The Exchange, worked for Robert Kennedy years ago, worked in the Clinton administration, resigned over the president's signing of the Welfare Reform Bill in 1996. He's a professor of law and public policy at Georgetown University, the faculty director there of the Center on Poverty and Inequality. We'll come back and talk more with Peter and take some phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Peter Edelman at Georgetown University. Well, he's from Georgetown University. He's not actually there at the moment because he's on his book tour. His book is called Not a Crime to be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Many stories you've heard before, especially on NPR, coverage of modern-day debtors' prisons in which people get a small fine, can't pay it, go to jail, get more fines on top of that, and end up owing something like $11,000 from an original charge of a couple of hundred. You can join the conversation on The Exchange as we begin to talk about solutions. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what other, you mentioned Cook County is making some efforts to begin to separate mental health treatment from incarceration. Given that we did downsize the state hospitals and didn't really replace them with the community health centers that were envisioned decades ago, what other options do we have for dealing with people who need help from a mental health system that is not robust enough to help them?
Well, the heart of it, of course, is what you were just saying that we didn't do. We need to have a robust set of community-based services, mental health services, that will help people without having to put them in some kind of institution. And you know, the vast number of people who have issues of mental health problems can be met in that way, and we just have to. I mean, it's easy to say, but it's also our responsibility to invest in those things. And you know, it's the old thing: you pay now or you pay me later. Those kinds of services are going to actually save money down the road in having to have some kind of incarceration. So what happens here in the places where something is being done, and I also mentioned L.A. County, and that's where I am right at the moment. So last night I was talking to people in Los Angeles County and the work that they're doing. And so at least if you have people, you don't have the services within the community that you need to have or they're not good enough. If people are going to be in the jails and the prisons, they need to have decent community, decent mental health services within those places, and also that connect out to support when they get out. And that's what people are doing, at least in those two places, and perhaps, I'm sure, in a few other places in the country, although not nearly enough.
Let's take a call here. We have Dana in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Edelman, who wrote Not a Crime to be Poor. Hi, Dana.
What's your name?
Go ahead.
Donna.
Oh, Donna, go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask him about the mentality or the ideology and stereotype of this group of people, I'll just say needy people, and the connection with way back I believe in the 50s, the book The Other America, and the fact that for religious groups, at least Christian groups, Jesus says, even as you have done this unto others, you have done it unto me. So it appears to me that some of the religious groups should be really supporting your action, and I want to thank you for taking on a difficult, challenging, and important career.
All right. Thanks for that, Don. Appreciate it. Your thoughts, Peter?
Well, thank you to the caller. And it's absolutely true that one of the components to go in the right direction here is people of faith, who in many instances we know are deliver services for people who need that kind of help, and people who this should be true of people who for moral reasons and because it's the right thing, who aren't particularly faith-based. That's also important. But I think that what she says is one of the things that we need to do. She mentions The Other America, Michael Harrington's classic book in the 1960s. And, of course, that is sort of the contemporary, the modern time when we woke up to the fact that we had poverty in the United States. And we've done a lot since then. We would have, with all the things, and, you know, you have Paul Ryan and you have these people right now as we talk who, after this terrible tax bill goes to help the rich people, the next thing they're going to say, they are saying it, is they're going to have a big deficit, and the way they're going to deal with it is to whack the poor people. So it's a double whammy, and we need to stand up about that, because he should not be allowed to say that these things don't work. If we didn't have Social Security, if we didn't have the Earned Income Tax Credit and SNAP, which is food stamps, and a number of other things, we would actually have twice as many people in poverty than we do right now. On the other hand, 43 million people are poor, and the basic thing is we've turned into a low-wage America. And we need to wake up to that and do what's necessary for people to end up with a living income.
Let us take another call here. We have Philip in Yreka on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, actually, it's Yreka. Your previous caller mentioned something. I wanted to comment on it, then I had another statement. The reality is, you know, it's amazing what absence there is regarding comments from the religious organizations, whether they be Christian, evangelical, or Jewish, whatever, regarding what's happening in the world and what the American foreign policy is regarding bombing other countries and so forth. You don't hear nothing from them. And then someone says to me, well, the fact of the matter is they don't pay taxes, and they want to preserve their situation where they don't pay taxes because they're in the business of, I don't know, I'm not sure what they're in the business of. Anyway, the next subject I wanted to mention was the war on poverty that LBJ initiated is no longer saleable. You can't get the public to fight poverty, but you can have war on people. You can have militant war on collecting people in the streets and throwing them in jail. That sells. That will get funded. And the fact of the matter is, if you wanted to change in public opinion, you have to depend on what? ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox, NPR, to constantly make people aware of what a sad, sad situation it is that's happening to a lot of people in this country. And I'll listen to your comment off the air.
All right. Thank you, Phil. I appreciate that.
Yes. We're not doing what we should. And one of the reasons is something that's been true really throughout the history of our world, that there are people who believe that those who have less aren't deserving, that they have some fault, and of course everybody has to be responsible for what they do, but there is this point of view that anybody who doesn't have enough money, that it must be their own fault. And so that's not a new idea. And we did better in the 60s and on into the 70s even. But it's important to understand that we do have had success in terms of not so much from a mass kind of advocacy, but things that we've done nationally and so on. But the thing that we need, both about what I've written here, and we do see it, I must say, about people fighting back about mass incarceration now. I think that has become something that we could call a movement. And, you know, part of it is that you have people on the right who also want to change mass incarceration because, it's, among other things, it's expensive. But the larger thing in terms of how do we get, my own view is that we should understand that we have over 100 million people in this country who have incomes below twice the poverty line. That means under $40,000 for a family of three. And I think we really need to think about this as not people that are living in poverty as some other. It's really a continuum. People go in and out of poverty, and then they're somewhat above that. Really, the point where we should be thinking is who are all the people in this country who really can't, the next thing that happens to them, they're just one paycheck away from being in poverty again. And think about it that way, because there's politics there. If we talk about 103 million people, most of whom do vote, and at least that's the way I would think about it in trying to organize and trying to get a positive response.
Do we need to do things like raise minimum wages? I mean, what are some of the components of just bringing the bottom up to make less poverty?
Yes, well, that's the heart. That's the best thing. It doesn't solve all the problems. You know, we also have to have kids growing up with better education and all that goes with having better jobs. But in terms of income itself, for people who are working, if we raise the minimum wage to a level that would be much, much better, well, it doesn't, you know, hurt the number of jobs and so on. And then various things that, you know, if you have, for example, more help with child care, and which is just very important in and of itself, but also it is an equivalent, it's a money equivalent thing. The same with help with housing vouchers, which only reach one out of four people in the country, and the federal money on child care is one out of seven people, is only enough there for that. And of course, health care, and we're back in a with this tax bill there and other things they may do. Medicaid has become so helpful to millions and millions of people. Well, that also has an anti-poverty effect. So there are things that are just right before, you know, in front of our face that we do and that we can do better. You know, it's not some exotic thing. It's basically things that will end up with more income or more equivalence, cash equivalence.
But we're entering this age now, and of course, you know, this is on fresh on the mind because we had a discussion about artificial intelligence yesterday in this hour. But the idea that there are going to be fewer jobs in the future as machines are able to do more and more things. I mean, this runs the possibility that you'll have even more people who are not making a great deal of money.
Well, we've got to wake up about all these things. That's certainly possible to make things more difficult. And with this terrible tax bill, one can hope that it's not going to go all the way through, but it looks like it will. That's going to take states, particularly states like Oregon and California. It's going to tighten the revenues there and make it harder at the state and local level. So that's even more immediate than what you're talking about. But both are important.
You know, I noticed one of the discussions you have in the book about anti-poverty programs is about two-generation programs.
Yes.
Which I realize, though, that you know, John Conyers aside, people who defend such things do not tend to stay in office for two generations. And so things can change every 2 years, every 4 years, you know?
I guess that's part of it. You know, it is this two-gen things, as they call it, where we're working both with directly with the children and child development, also with the families in terms of the economic strength of the families, and I in the book I talk about down in Tulsa, a brilliant man named Stephen Dow, where they made Head Start into a whole family thing. A lot of the what has to happen in terms of creating an infrastructure for people has to happen in communities. I mean, they do need outside funding from the state and federal government, but the strength of really helping families and nurturing children and building community, we have to do that where we live among all of us who are there. And we see places around the country who are doing that sort of thing, and we need to emulate that elsewhere.
A final question, and we have less than a minute now, Peter, but when we talk about decarceration, it looked like there was a good roll toward criminal justice reform in early 2016, and then we had the election. We've got a president right now who accuses people of being terrible on border, terrible on crime. I mean, in this climate, is it really hard to push for things like decarceration and criminal justice reform?
Well, it's always difficult. The slightly good news about the criminal justice system and ultimately decarceration, which means really going through the whole statute book and getting the right penalties for things. That was done in California in Prop 47, which is a terrific thing. And I think it can happen in other states.
All right. We will see down the road. The book is called Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. Peter Edelman from Georgetown University wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Peter, thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Take care.